Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, the essential podcast for middle market business owners, key stakeholders, and the advisors who guide them. I'm Josh Pottinger and joined by my co-host, Jason Chirogiannis. Together, we lead ATX Wealth Partners, a private wealth management team at UBS here in Austin, Texas. Now, over the course of almost 30 years, we've built a vibrant community and have curated a suite of resources tailored for your success, from insightful white papers and cutting-edge research to exclusive in-person events and expert-led podcasts. We are here to provide the tools that you need. Now, if you're considering an exit, this is likely the most significant financial decision of your life, and typically, you only have one chance to get it right. So our mission is clear: to arm you with the knowledge to enhance the value of your business, navigate a successful sale, and of course, optimize your post-exit financial outcomes. Now with that, let's dive in and unlock the strategies that will prepare you for a prosperous future. Hello, everyone. It's Josh Pottinger here with ATX Wealth Partners at UBS, and we have got another episode ready to rock here. This is going to be number 24. We've got Joe Walsh with us today. He's an attorney that specializes in mergers and acquisitions. And so Joe and I have gotten to know each other over the past, I guess, couple of years now.
At least.
And yeah, so Joe's right here in Austin, Texas. So Joe is with Selman, Munson, and Lerner. They have a presence not only here in Austin, but also up in Dallas and in Houston. They represent buyers and sellers in mergers and acquisition transactions involving both private and public businesses, and also helping in negotiating with private equity, venture capital companies, investment bankers, institutional investors for private financing and investment. So, Joe, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Good. So I much prefer doing these in person. You know, we had to go through the period of time where everything was remote. So
yeah, I'm an in-person person too, so it works.
So, well, good. Well, for the audience there, if you haven't listened in on any of the other previous episodes, you know, the intent here is to bring in some specialists in their respective areas, with a focus on helping owners and key stakeholders of privately held companies facilitate a more seamless process, a more efficient process, and at the end of the day, a more lucrative process. I wanted to bring Joe in today to talk about it from a legal perspective. And so as a business owner out there, you have a lot on your plate. And so our hope is that listening to this conversation will give you some things to think about and some questions to bring up to your own team and hopefully help lead to a better process. So I'm going to stop babbling on here, Joe, and let's get into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay, good. So let's kick it off here. Like, what can owners do now, like before an exit transaction, to positively impact their sales process and their sales price?
So as you mentioned, business owners have a lot on their plate, right? So the answer to that question isn't complicated, but it's not easy. And it is prepare, prepare, prepare. As we like to say, you get your team in place and you get your documents in place and you get your process in place. So initially, you want to make sure you have your team, whether that is your financial advisor, your accountant, your lawyer. You might want to deal with an investment banker or a broker. These are the people who are going to help you through this process and shepherd you through. Business owners need to remember their main objective is to run their business day to day. A buyer, most buyers' main objective, that's all they do. They buy and sell companies all day, every day. This is what they do. They spend all their time doing it. They have armies and armies of lawyers and accountants and advisors. So when they descend upon you in this exit transaction, you're really going to be overwhelmed. And if you've taken the time to prepare, talk to your accountants, say, you know, are my books in order financially? Talk to your lawyers. Are there some things I can clean up as we get into this process? Talk to your financial advisor, say, this is the amount of money I think I want to take away from this transaction. Mm-hmm. And talk to an intermediary, an investment banker or a business broker. These are people who are out in the market. They know what's going on out there. They understand what's transacting. So they're, you know, as an initial just talking process, they can tell you, market's looking good, pretty good right now. I'm seeing X, Y, and Z. But you want to get that team together and in place so you're working seamlessly throughout a transaction. Because again, this is one of the harder things an owner's ever going to have to do. And that's because you have to run your business and run this process. And mm-hmm. either of those things individually could be a full-time job. So you really got to be ready.
And if you have a family, that's another part.
You do, exactly. There's all kinds of things on your plate. And you just have to remember that if you get your professional team in place, they're the people who do this all the time too, right? This is what I do every day. I help, generally I'm on the sell side, but I'm helping owners through this process. Mm-hmm. While I don't know exactly what they're feeling, I've gone through it with other owners. There's an emotional component. There's a work component. There's a family component. There's so much to this. Mm-hmm. You can really rely on someone like me, your investment banker, people who have done this before, ask questions, learn about it, educate yourself before you get an LOI or before you undertake going to market. Because the more you know now, learning it during diligence or learning it, you know, once you get the LOI, mm-hmm. that's a lot. It's a lot to do. So the more you can prepare and get ready for it and give yourself some lead time, the better. You don't have to get everyone. I'm not telling you to go out and hire 5 professionals tomorrow.
Right.
But at least talk to one of these individuals who's done a sale process before and start to pick their brain.
Start talking, start having conversations. You know, in effect, it's sort of a soft interviewing process.
Correct.
Where you're trying to figure out who your ultimate deal team is going to be.
Exactly. You might have a lawyer you've worked with. They might do other things than M&A transactions, but you could start to talk to them. They might introduce you to a few other lawyers. Uh-huh. People who are in the deal community, the deal space, like you said, we've known each other for a couple of years now. It's a small world. So, you know, we know people. I work with certain investment bankers all the time, work with certain accountants. Uh-huh. So they're going to be able to, if you find one individual, one professional, they're also going to be able to help you make some introductions and say, hey, you know, talk to him for a little bit. You don't have to hire him, but mm-hmm. go have this conversation and see what you think.
Right. So. And from, you know, the training that we got through the Exit Planning Institute, through our SEPA work, thinking about it from the three legs of the stool, right? Personal, financial, and then corporate.
Correct.
So the deal team, usually, like my default when I think deal team is usually specific to the company.
Correct.
But from an owner standpoint or a key stakeholder, integrating those conversations or weaving the conversation around a potential event through how that affects you personally, how that affects you financially. And then obviously on the corporate side, that's a really critical component because that's where the biggest asset lies.
Correct. And it's a huge component on the corporate side, right? Not all businesses are just owned by one individual. You might have partners, members, however you're structured, mm-hmm. but you might own this business with someone else. You two have to talk it through. There might be a few people in the company who you're really not going to get through a transaction without them there. Mm-hmm. You might have to start, you know, you're not looking to air it all out to every employee, but there's going to be some people there you might have to have some conversations with early on to say, hey, you know, we're thinking about going down this road. I'm going to need your help. And that might be a tough conversation, but it's important to mm-hmm. have. So there's not just external professionals. There's also some internal things you have to prepare for.
Right. So we talked about that actually in one of our roundtable discussions that we had, which is certain key individuals or key employees that you may need to pull into the tent.
Correct. And one of the things we were potentially going to talk about is certain legal documents you might want to have in place. And one of the things if an employee doesn't hold equity, what we call it is a transaction bonus letter. You might want to go to your CFO because they're going to be, if you have a CFO controller type person in your organization, mm-hmm. That person is going to be intimately involved in this process because so many buyers are going to want so much financial information and you'll find a lot of things flow through the CFO or controller's office. So you might want to go to them and give them what we call a transaction bonus letter. And that's a letter that pretty much says, hey, you know, we're going to go forward in this transaction. If we close it, we'll give you X. Mm-hmm. That could be a cash number, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It could be a percentage of the sale process, you know, especially if this person's been with you a long time and you never gave them equity or always thought you might give them equity. Mm-hmm. This is an opportunity to give them a piece of this transaction. Mm-hmm. They'll be invested in it. They'll stick around for it because you're going to need them, which is important.
Right.
But that's some of those things. If you engage your legal professional early enough, mm-hmm. you might be able to say, okay, I've got these few people. Let's do that with them. We'll get them on board. We'll get their buy-in and we'll give them, you know, some of the upside.
Mm-hmm. In that transaction letter that you just mentioned, do you see any sort of like a vesting schedule for that amount of money? Like how do you prevent somebody from going through the deal and then they're gone?
And then leaving? Yes. That's part of a problem. and this all depends also how soon you start your process.
Maybe they need to go because...
They might. Sometimes it's not up to you. Buyer might be making this decision for you, right?
Right.
But you're certainly going to need to get them to get to closing. Mm. If it's early enough on, you could set up more of a vesting schedule. You know, if owner comes to me and says, I think I'm going to maybe exit 3 to 5 years, that's a little different setup. We can say, okay, maybe we can get them equity. We can have it vest. And we could have, you know, a corporate transaction would trigger full vesting, meaning they get all of it.
Right.
But some of these folks, if it's just, you know, if we have 3 months, 4 months, and, you know, the deal is going to happen, it's happening quick, and we go to them, usually we'll structure it that there's a payment at closing. Sometimes, and you get buyer involved, and it could be more complicated, we'll say you get half at closing, half 6 months after. Because even if you're not going to stick around forever, stick around for the transition. So there are opportunities to do that. But certainly anything you're doing that impacts the post-transaction company, buyer is going to be a little more involved in that.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the legal agreements that need to be in place before you decide to sell the business.
Absolutely. So your core legal document would be your governing documents. And this might sound somewhat pedestrian to some people, but you'd be surprised how often you get a client and maybe their certificate of formation has forgot to file something with the Secretary of State and it's been terminated. Not a huge deal. We can fix that, right? We revive it. We file a new certificate. We make sure they're in good standing. A governing document of some sort. Most entities these days are in the limited liability company, LLC format. That governing document would be called a company agreement or an operating agreement. If there's more than one owner, it's important you have an operating agreement. Otherwise, you're defaulting to the statutory provisions in Texas or wherever you're incorporated. Mm-hmm. So that's an important document to have in place. Is it signed? Is it comprehensive? What does it call for? Some of the other documents you'd want in place, a lot of this depends on the type of company you're dealing with. But if you have employees that are creating any type of intellectual property, buyer's going to come in and want to see what we call inventions assignments agreements, meaning employee, you're doing this work for the company. Everything you create belongs to the company. It's assigned to the company. So you can understand in certain businesses, if you don't have those agreements in place, that's going to make a buyer very concerned, right?
Right.
Where's this IP?
Right.
Who created it? Who owns it? Mm-hmm. And this is the main asset of the business.
Mm-hmm.
So you definitely want an employment invention assignment. Not all entities have employment agreements. You know, it's just not something you see. Most employment is at will. But if you do have some key employees, again, if they're not already under an employment agreement, that bonus transaction letter we talked about, that can become more of a quasi-employment, you know, 6 month year employment agreement with the transaction bonus. We make sure those people are tied up.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on what type of business you're in, customer contracts. If you actually, if you're not just on a purchase order basis and you have customer contracts, number one, do you have them? And number two, are they signed? You wouldn't be surprised how many times we get the customer diligence comes in and it's customer contracts and they're all signed by our company, the seller, the client, but it's never countersigned. We say, do you have a full one? Do you have a fully executed version? And you know, they got to go scramble around to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be some of the key corporate documents that any buyer is going to be initially looking for. The diligence process, it's voluminous. They're going to ask for anything and everything. But if we're just talking kind of the building blocks that if you don't have these in place, you shouldn't be going to market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talk to your attorney, get ready. There's other things. You might have a line of credit or a financing arrangement, right? Things like things of that nature a buyer is going to want to see. Not all companies have a loan or a note or financing in place. If you have equipment leases, things like that, just start to show some good corporate hygiene. And make sure you have copies of these documents and agreements.
So governing docs, certificate of corporation, operating agreements, invention assignment agreements.
Yeah, we call it, we have a confidentiality and inventions assignment agreement. So in essence, it's a IP protective document.
Okay.
It's a long one. I'm sorry. I didn't make it up.
Employment agreements.
Correct.
Customer contracts that are signed by both sides. Equipment leases. Okay. Lots of stuff there.
Yeah. There's a lot of paper. And some companies don't have that much paper and others have a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really very specific to the company. But if you don't have, if you seem to struggle, when buyer comes in, again, professional buyer does this all the time. If you seem to be struggling with simple requests, such as where's your company agreement, you know, that's going to raise some some flags. Mm-hmm. I'm a lawyer on the buyer side sometimes, right? And I can't, if I ask what I think is a pretty simple question, give me your governing docs, and it takes a couple weeks, I'm thinking, what's going on? Right. Well, what's the problem here?
Right.
If there's an answer, oh, we're redoing it, here's the old one, we're redoing a new one, that's something. But sure. Just, I can't find it because we formed the company 15 years ago and, you know, it doesn't exist. It happens, but.
I think from a buyer's perspective too, if you're getting these little negative clues, that's going to detract from your value.
It is. And it could change the nature of the structure of the transaction, right? There's usually two types of transactions. You're either selling equity, meaning the stock or the membership interest, or you're selling assets. So the buyer would not take the entity. Oftentimes, it may be better for a seller to sell equity. It can be sometimes tax-wise better to just sell equity. But if you can't show the company they're about to step into, buyer is, that it's in good shape. You know, there's some corporate minutes, there's some documents, they're not going to want to touch it. So if they just buy assets, they can better attempt to cut off that liability. Uh-huh. So if you show an inability that anyone would want to own the equity in that entity, you're lessening your options to get a better, potentially better sale process for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So we talked about some of the legal agreements. Let's move on to financial and accounting items that should be in place.
Absolutely. So you're going to want to talk with your accountant when you're talking about entering into an exit transaction. Not all buyers would require an audited financial statement, but to an extent, you're getting ready to undertake an exit process. A buyer is going to have certain expectations that your financials are GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, right? They're GAAP compliant. Often, you could do that without an audit. But it's probably close enough to an audit. Go to your accountant and say, hey, I would like to start a review, you know, either get reviewed or audited financial statements. Because most buyers want to know, did someone else look at your numbers, test them a little bit, and validate it? So to the extent you can do that, it's sometimes audits are cost prohibitive, but they're gonna make the process easier. Because again, that buyer is going to come in with some, not all the time, but most of the time, some big accounting firm. And there's going to be 5, 10, 11 of them, and they're going to pick through all these numbers. So if you talk to your accountant about it and you have an audit and you're ready to go, it's going to make that process a lot easier. We're going through a process right now. We have a client, no audit, financials just done internally, and we have PwC coming in and doing the accounting diligence. It's a lot because we're having to justify and prove up everything, right? Because there's no kind of external audit reviewed statement there. It just makes it a little more difficult. Another thing sometimes the sellers will do is what's called the quality of earnings report. You could go to your account and get a quality of earnings. That's often used by buyers, especially private equity buyers. If there isn't an audit, they'll go out and get what's called a quality of earnings report. And that, again, that is kind of what it sounds. It's an accounting firm coming in and testing your numbers and making sure that it matches. You need to get your accounting house in order. That is going to be diligence item number one, top priority. So talk to your accountant. If you don't think your accountant's ready to go through a sale process with you, not all are, you might need to shop around and find an accountant with a little more comprehensive offerings.
Okay. So audited financials are nice.
They are.
We need them to be GAAP compliant.
Correct.
And be prepared for something called the quality of earnings, QOE.
Yes. They've become quite popular. It used to be just private equities, but you're seeing it a lot more. We even have some people who work on the investment banking side who, when they engage a sell-side client, will go ahead and do a sell-side quality of earnings. So before, when they take on the client, they kind of understand, okay, owner came in and told me I've got, his business has $2.5 million in EBITDA. I'm going to test that. I want to see, before I even take him to market, I want to test it on my own, right? Because I'm going to be the one outselling him. So they'll go do either a quality of earnings or something, quality of earnings light, and kind of test that number and see if that's where they are.
Who pays for that?
If it's a sell side QOE, if that would be the seller would pay for it. Oftentimes on the buy side, if they're doing a buy side QOE, that would be a buyer expense, just like the buyer's paying their lawyers, they're paying their accountants and things like that. But it can be a length.
Is that worth it for a seller to spend that money?
Yes, it can be oftentimes. A lot of private equity buyers are going to do it anyway. They might take yours and test it. But certain things, and we might get into it later in the conversation, if you're going to get something what's called rep and warranty insurance in your transaction, almost any rep and warranty insurer will require either a quality of earnings or an audited financial statement or both. So to the extent you're looking at that as an option, it helps. It helps I think the seller understand really where their company is. I think it helps their investment banker understand what they're shopping out there. Is the EBITDA close to what seller thinks it is, the owner thinks it is?
Yeah.
So it can be very advantageous.
So you're bringing up rep and warranty.
Mm-hmm.
From what I've read, it's becoming more and more of a normalized
Absolutely.
Thing that people are getting, that it's being required, right? And so let's dig into that a little bit.
Absolutely.
On what that is and why it exists.
Why is it important?
And why is it important?
It's very important. And you're correct. We've seen it become much more prevalent and it's come down market. So when it started as a product, you wouldn't even have looked at rep and warranty insurance if you were, you know, maybe below $50, $60 million in enterprise value.
Right.
Now you're seeing it transactions that are in the $15, $20 million range.
Okay.
So I kind of got to go back to some legalese, so don't everybody get bored right away. But when a seller enters into a transaction, there's a concept called indemnity. So the seller makes all these reps to the buyer, and the seller has to stand behind those reps. And there's this concept called indemnification. So after the closing, if the buyer finds out there was a rep was wrong, they may make a claim against the seller. It's called an indemnity claim. That indemnity claim is the responsibility of the seller. Oftentimes, buyers, to protect themselves, say, okay, at closing, I'm going to give you 90% of the purchase price. I'm going to put 10% of it in an escrow account.
Uh-huh.
Because if I got to make one of these indemnity claims, I want to know the money's there.
Right.
So you're talking about 10% of your cash, sometimes 20% of your cash, not coming to you at closing. It's going to sit in an escrow account that's not going to be making any money. Mm-hmm. I know, Josh, you probably love that, right? Money not making any money. So it's sitting there in that account. You can't touch it. It could be a year, 18 months, 2 years. So what the rep and warranty insurance does is it takes away the need for an escrow. Because now when buyer has a claim, he doesn't need to go to seller. It's an insurance product. He goes to the insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
So these rep and warranty policies are fantastic. And what we're seeing both, like I said, they're coming down market, they're becoming more prevalent, but there's now real data out there for the last 10 or 15 years. The claims that are being made, and there's not a lot of claims, but they're getting paid. These insurers want to be in this space. They want to be in this market. They're even coming up with more bespoke type, you know, if you have one issue on tax, they might insure that. So this is kind of where they want to be. They seem to be very aggressive in their pricing. Pricing has come down on rep and warranty insurance policies. So it's a good thing for buyers and sellers, right? Because if seller goes to work for the buyer and they're an important employee after the closing, buyer doesn't want to be suing that seller, that employee for money, right?
Yeah.
That's not a good situation.
Right.
Rather, you go to the insurance company and you make these claims. There's a cost to it. There's a premium, which can be about 1%-ish.
Uh-huh.
And then there is obviously the underwriting fees. Oftentimes we try and push that on the buyer. We can't always though, so we'll see. And then there's something what's called a retention, which would be in essence your insurance deductible. So on a policy, it might be 0.5%. So say the first $500,000 of the deductible or the retention, someone has to pay in cash. So again, buyer and seller might split that number. So 250, 250. But seller's only giving up that 250 in cash at closing now, as opposed to millions of dollars, right? So it's a great product. I highly recommend that any seller who's thinking about an exit have that conversation with their investment banker or their lawyer when they go to market. Say, you know, I'd like to make this a deal term. That I want the buyer to come to me. They wouldn't have a written policy yet, but that they went out and they shopped it. They know what it's going to cost. Doesn't work for all transactions. Like any insurance policy, there might be exclusions, but I couldn't recommend it more. As you can probably tell Josh can tell by looking at me, it makes life easier for everybody.
Well, you sparked something in my head. I think I might have to have a whole podcast on reps and warranties.
Yeah.
I've got somebody that's got a lot of experience in that space, and I think it might be worth bringing them on.
I think it is. A lot of corporate M&A CLEs you go to, there's always, almost always, a whole section on rep and warranty insurance because it has become so prevalent. And I talked about the cost, but there's efficiencies built in. So when the lawyers are negotiating and there's a rep and warranty policy, we're not negotiating for hours or days on the indemnification provisions, right? We're just saying we're going to look to the insurer. That saves you time. That saves you money.
Right.
When it comes down to negotiating the reps, if there's no rep and warranty insurance policy, we're going through every rep with looking for materiality or knowledge. When the policy's in place, that also becomes a lot easier. There might be a upfront cost, but the efficiency of the process,
you
probably
process.
Gain some. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear a podcast.
Huh? Yeah. Well, that's it. Wow, that's going to be a sexy one, huh? Almost as sexy as this one, law talk. So.
I know. When I tell people I have a podcast, they're just like, oh, what's it on? I'm like, it's pretty specialized. We're talking about some nerdy stuff. So, but it's really important. And, you know, I mean, I'm like a broken record. I mean, this is the biggest financial event, usually the biggest financial event of someone's life. And you only got one shot at it. And that's it. You better make sure you got it. Good team and you know what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's the old adage, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. And that's true in life and in the deal world.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And the owners are up such a, I mean, like you start out the podcast, you know, it's like these buyers are doing it every day. That's what they do. They get up in the morning, they buy companies. Yeah. You've never done it before. So.
Yeah. That's why you need the nerdy lawyers who's sitting here loving to talk to you about it for an hour or more. And
yes. And the private wealth guys like me to help you with everything after. When you get a big pile of capital to manage. So, all right. So, hey, what are the different types of buyers and how will that impact a transaction? So, you know, we've got our financial buyers, which are typically our private equity companies. There's a few $1 trillion washing around out there. They're super active. You got your strategics out there. Let's talk through that a little bit.
Absolutely. So, you mentioned the two biggest categories and really the most active categories. You have a strategic buyer, and that would be a company that is either looking to expand. Mm-hmm. And by buying the business, maybe they don't want to start a division, so they'll buy the division, they'll buy the seller. Strategic buyers usually want to buy the whole thing. They usually pay, you know, cash at closing. There might be, we talked about escrows and things like that, but they're usually paying you everything. You're out 100%. Sometimes they might not even need the seller to be employed and go along, right? There just might be a short transition period for the owner seller, and then they're gone.
They're out.
Seller go away. And it's not a bad thing if that's what the seller wants, right? This is all driven by what the seller owner wants in an exit. So that would be your strategic buyer. As you mentioned, your financial buyer would be private equity.
By the way, if it's a strategic buyer and it's a sell and go away, you better make sure that company is transferable.
Correct.
Without you.
Correct.
I mean, absolutely. So, yeah.
That is an important aspect. And you probably had it on some of your other podcasts. Like, is the company sellable? Is it transferable?
Yep.
No, it's true. And because not all businesses are transferable like that. So it's an important aspect. But that's why it's good. So for certain businesses where the strategics wouldn't be really the exit, either the owner wants or that a buyer would want, you have this private equity exit or financial buyer. And generally speaking, the private equity company is going to come in and it's more of, in essence, a recap. They're not going to buy all of you. They're going to buy 80%, 70%.
Right.
And then they're going to want you to roll over into the transaction and stick around. So you're going to have, number one, you're going to still be running this business. Number two, you're still going to have equity in this business. Mm-hmm. That equity amount can skew depending on private equity. Most private equity buyers come in and want 80-ish percent, right? They want control. There are some who will come in and do minority positions, but that's fewer and far between. So what private equity does is they come in, they buy 80%. They will then want you, if you're their main platform company, they will help you grow. They might help you acquire other businesses. And then hopefully maybe 3, 5, 7 years down the road, there's a second exit for private equity. They sell and there's a second exit for the owner. So the financial buyer transaction isn't necessarily like we talked about, sell and go away. Uh-huh. It's sell, stick around, grow, acquire, exit again. And that's not for everyone. It really depends on what the owner is looking for. When you go into this transaction, you're going to get, if you're running some type of process, you're going to get interest from both. And you're going to need to kind of weigh that as to what an owner wants to do. Oftentimes you will see, as we just talked about, there's a little more cash at closing if you sell to a strategic. And sometimes strategic's prices can be a little higher. And again, I'm talking in general terms, right? Private equity is using someone else's money and they're coming in and they are grinding out every single number deal term they can. Strategic buyers oftentimes, and not always, will have a little bit more a different approach when it comes to diligence and things of that nature. But it's really up to the owner. They got to think through, do I want to stick around with 20% of this business and wait another 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, that leads to a very important question for business owners to ask themselves, which is, how much gas in the tank do I have?
Yep.
Right? And so we're huge advocates of people educating themselves so that they can understand their questions and start planning early, like earlier than they think.
Yeah.
Because if you're waiting till you're at a quarter tank and
you've got a really good deal from a from a financial buyer, but you don't have much gas in the tank left. Is that really the best option for you?
Yeah, right? That's right.
So
the other aspect too, oftentimes owners have to think about, and they don't until it's too late, is do I want to go work for someone? Because when PE buys 80% of you, you're working for PE. If you've owned a business for years and you haven't reported to anyone, right, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. some people have to be self-aware enough to look at it and say, I don't think I can do that. Some people can, some people can't.
Sure. So,
but yeah. it's another thing to
personality, think about through the process. I mean, there's certainly a certain personality character. I mean, that sort of rubs opposite directions, because you get entrepreneurs and founders that are used to doing things their own way.
Correct.
And then they got to hop to the other side of the table. So
it can be interesting and mm-hmm. it can be great, because you could get that second bite at the apple.
Sure.
But it's just not for everyone.
Yeah. Okay. Well, some other types of exits, you know, are employee stock.
Yeah. ESOPs, employee stock options. Yeah. Sometimes it's a generational transfer, and you can do that with actually having the second generation mm-hmm. do some type of purchase, not just a gift. Certainly there's more of a management buyout if there is, you know, if you have a management group of three mm-hmm. people and they want to take it over from the owner, that happens. Oftentimes these are not going to be, if there's any purchase price, they're not going to be big purchase prices, right? Because you have a management group who probably doesn't have the funds to come up with the cash. So you're looking at selling it to them probably with some type of note involved at a pretty high percentage of the sale price, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not out. You're still invested enough in this business because you might, you know, have a note for 30, 40% and you want to see it succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So you see those are some of the other exits, but they're certainly not the ones that would derive the most cash value.
Yeah.
They might give the owner what they want. Hey, these three people have been with me forever. I want to see them take this mm-hmm. and do with it what they might. So again, it all goes back to the owner sitting down and before they get into the process and thinking about, talking about what they want mm-hmm. to do, where they want this to see this company go. Do they want it to go to the next generation? Does the next generation want it? So there's all those types of things. And you probably see it often too. It's a hard conversation.
Sure. When you're thinking about how to convert an illiquid asset, a large illiquid asset, into a liquid asset, what are your options to start taking a few chips off the table mm-hmm. along the way and possibly selling a piece to the financial buyer, maybe a recap using some debt to scrape some money off the table? Any other thoughts on that?
Again, that's what the owner's got to decide. You could do you might be able to help the management team, are you talking about, getting a recap and, mm-hmm. and take some money out. That's possible. Again, then you have an entity that you want to survive and thrive and be able to finance that debt. And are you burdening it too much?
Mm-hmm.
So that's another, but I can understand, and you probably educate your clients more than I would when the lawyer gets engaged, but people forget sometimes, they think of their kind of net worth and they think of what's in their portfolio and their bank account and these things. They don't remember that, like you said, that illiquid asset, that is their net worth.
Mm-hmm.
So de-risking that, whether by selling it to management or selling 80% to private equity, mm-hmm. that can change your whole structure of what your worth looks like.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the steps in a sale transaction and kind of the length of time. Length of time, I usually budget, it's like how long it takes to bake a baby, 9 months, right? I mean, what are your, I mean, I know some can be a lot quicker, some can be longer, but let's kind of talk high level steps in the sale.
Sure.
General time frame.
Yeah. So general time frame, I'm going to start at owner has decided he wants to pursue an exit, right? Because there could be years that lead up to preparing for that. But owner comes to me, they've done all their preliminary work. They say, hey, I want to look into an exit process. I'll say, okay, you should go talk to an investment banker or a business broker. So from when those conversations start with the investment banker, it's probably 9 months to a year, could go longer, could go shorter, but you're going to meet with your investment banker. They're going to ask you all kinds of financial questions. They're going to put together some type of book, a confidential information memorandum, something of that nature. And then they're going to go potentially run a process. So they will go to all their contacts and say, hey, look, I've got this company that's on the market. And at this point in time, no one knows who you, seller owner, are, right? It's all blinded. So they're going to go work that process and get initial feedback from the market. And that will look like in the form of people wanting to sign NDAs with the broker and get more information, right? Because the first piece is kind of what we would call a teaser. You know, it's maybe a sheet or two about the company. It does manufacturing. the financial metrics are roughly this in EBITDA, this in sales. It'll give them just a teaser. And so the banker will go out and solicit some NDAs. Everyone who signs an NDA will then get more information on the company. Again, we're still trying to hold back who the company is because we don't want people just kicking the tires. That process will then lead to what we call indications of interest. So the broker will say, okay, everyone who got an NDA and got all the information, send me your indication of interest. That will usually be, as we go down this, Josh, right? It starts out with, I'm just going to use an example, 1,000. We go out to 1,000 buyers. Yep. Only 200 sign an NDA. That might be a little high. We might get, you know, 15, 20, 30 indications of interest. Those indications of interest would usually, the broker would say, give me a range of value you might expect this company, you would buy for this company. So now we're starting to test that market, right? Brokers doing their job. They're testing the market. They're seeing what it looks like. Because you'd be surprised. Sometimes an owner comes in, thinks his business is worth $10 million. Broker takes it to market. It's actually worth $20 million, right? Sometimes owner comes in, thinks his business is worth $20 million. Broker takes it to market. It's with $10 million. I mean, that's, we talk about market principles. That's why you do it. That's why you run that process. So then your broker, you'd look at the indications of interest, and then you would pick one, two, depends on how many buyers you want to go down the road with, and you'd enter into an LOI. That's a little bit more of a binding. It's not binding, but it's a little bit more of, hey, this is the price. These are the terms. That's when you start to talk about more specific deal terms. This is going to be an equity sale. The purchase price is going to be $10 million. We are going to buy 80%. We expect you to roll 20%. We expect you to be employed by the company. This is when you're going to get into some more hard deal terms. And that process that I just described is kind of the beginning stages, right? That would probably take 3, 4, 5 months. Then once you get into an LOI, generally when you sign, from when you sign an LOI to when you close.
What's going to take 3 to 5 months?
That could take 3 to 5 months working with your broker, your investment banker.
Okay. Right?
Then you get a signed LOI. That's when the transaction is more real. That's going to take you maybe another 3, 4 months.
Okay.
So from when you get the LOI, in essence, you've picked one of the buyers to go forward. You'll start negotiating with a lawyer, generally, the transaction documents, the definitive agreements. That's when, after the LOI, is when the diligence process will start. And as we talked about, that's where the owner, the preparation comes in, right? Because you sign the LOI and 2 days later, all those people I talked about, buyers have, all the professionals, they're all descending upon you with their lists, their diligence lists, and want all this information. Throughout that LOI process, there'll be diligence, there'll be legal documentation, and then hopefully we eventually get to a closing.
So just to recap what you just said, you know, the initial part is working with a banker.
Correct.
By the way, for the audience, investment bankers versus brokers, typically market cap size or enterprise
generally,
value, right?
Generally, the term broker is for the smaller transaction size enterprise value deals. I think if you got a broker and investment banker in here, they'd tell you the same thing. Yeah. When I think of business broker, I'm usually thinking of someone who's going up to, you know, maybe low teens, 15, maybe that high. And then you get your investment banker. And again, that's going to, it might not change the process for you that much, but it's going to change maybe how big a firm you're dealing with, their resources, and also their buying network, right? Because all these people are in this business and they've cultivated these buyers and this network of potential buyers. And they know the people, the broker might know the people who want to buy a $10 million company, whereas the investment bankers maybe going to have the relationship with PE who wants to spend 25, 50, whatever it might be.
Right.
So I hope I didn't offend any brokers or bankers. But no.
So initially, you're casting a wide net. It's all done on a confidential basis. Right. And then you collect NDAs. Then you move on to the indications of interest, which that whole process is typically like a 3 to 4 month process. And then you whittle it down to one or two, which you eventually sign a letter of engagement. Letter of intent. Correct. And then you go through the due diligence process with them. And then hopefully that leads to tidying up all the legal documents and ultimately a closing.
Correct. That's what we all hope for.
Okay.
It can be a long process. And again, this is, we're talking generalities, right? Sometimes things happen faster. Yep. Sometimes things happen a lot slower. Certainly with where the M&A market was last year and this year, kind of not as high as it was in 2020, 2021, there's a little bit more of a deliberate pace. Things that always, from signing LOI to closing, Mm-hmm. It seemed like in 2021, everything was 60 or 90 days. It was just like on repeat. Mm-hmm. Sign LOI, diligence close. That's just how the market was so hot. Now the market's coming back and it's great, but there's a lot more deliberate buyers out there. So the processes are taking a little longer. We're negotiating LOIs for a month as opposed to maybe a couple weeks. And that's the nature of what the market's willing to bear.
Right.
And how good a seller target might be.
So I remember seeing some statistics that out of the number of companies that go out there to sell themselves, that like only 30% of them reach a transaction.
I've seen some of those numbers. It's not accurate from what I see, but I'm seeing a small sample size. Mm-hmm. Certainly deals fail, but oftentimes at least when we see it in the transactions in our practice, especially over the last few years, most transactions that have gotten to LOI, a lot of them have closed.
Oh, really?
They have. And that's a good thing. And that's not a guarantee, because I just described that whole process to you. There's a certain amount of information you've given buyer, but they've not seen everything.
Right.
And they've not analyzed everything. Uh-huh. And some deals fail because there's something wrong. No one noticed it. No one was being dishonest, right? But there's just some problem. It took someone else kind of coming in and diligencing it and said, that changes the value. And the seller says, I thought I was going to get X. You want to give me Y? I'm going to walk away. That can be why the deals fail sometimes. But we've seen, thankfully, most of the LOIs go to closing.
Okay.
Well, maybe it's just good lawyering. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think maybe when they posted that statistic, I mean, they're looking at everything that just somebody that doesn't know what they're doing and just says, I just want to sell the company.
Yeah.
And they don't realize what they're up against.
Correct.
Also, what I've read and heard through conferences and whatnot, that oftentimes when deals do start to break down, it is during the due diligence process because the financials aren't in order and the legal documents aren't in order and all that stuff. It's just a hot mess. Yeah. Or the company's just too reliant on the owner. There's owner dependencies. There's customer concentration issues.
Yep. All kinds of things can happen. And it's unfortunate. But like you said, people and it's not always intentional. It's not always someone's fault. Mm-hmm. It's just, that's how the process goes. You want to give as little information as possible, get to an LOI, and then open it all up to someone really doing the diligence. And sometimes things come up.
Right. Which we have a recent case where a client took over a company and it was a family business. And it turns out there was no corporate governance going on. There was no accountability. And when this is all said and done, I'm going to have this client on to talk about
it'd be
the
very
lessons.
Enlightening.
Yeah. I mean, it's like kind of succession-y.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, it's crazy.
Maybe a couple part podcast.
Oh, my God.
Really build the suspense.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it could be a made for TV. It could be a movie. I don't know. But it's got a lot of people rooting for him on the sidelines.
Yeah.
But it's been an amazing, like, the last 3 or 4 weeks. So talk about like taking something over with some hidden demons. This was the case. So, for those of you out there, corporate governance, your CEO is accountable to the board of directors. Make sure you got a good board of directors. Make sure that board of directors is accountable to the shareholders. And so, and if they're all in cahoots, it's not a good thing. So,
no, not good.
There's a reason for this stuff. So, anyway, I was going to mention, how do we protect ourselves against post-closing claims from a buyer, but we kind of talked about that.
We did. We talked about rep and warranty insurance, and that's one of the bigger products out there now. The other way to kind of protect yourself is to, when you go through this process, some people get defensive, right? It's their company. It's their baby.
Sure.
Buyer's not coming in and trying to tell you you've done something wrong. They want to learn. They want to know what's going on. People want to, I don't mean hide information in kind of a mean-spirited way, but sometimes they're a little shy about it. And they just, this process, you have to disclose it all. Mm-hmm. You're going to stand behind all these reps and warranties. You're going to have schedules with all this information. Buyers, again, we're back to what we started with. These are professional buyers. They've seen far worse than you probably have. Don't be self-conscious. Don't be defensive. Mm-hmm. They're running a process. They're being honest and truthful about it. It's not personal. So, work that process. Give them everything in diligence. Answer their questions. The process of negotiating the purchase and sale agreement. You should sit with your attorney and your advisors and say, can I make this rep? If I can't, I'll tell buyer why. That's an opportunity. It's not just negotiating to try and win or anything like that. The reps and warranties in the schedules that are part of a definitive purchase agreement, that's an opportunity for the seller to tell the buyer, okay, we don't, you know, this is a little, the XYZ is a little off. We had some employee claims. Tell them about it. That's your opportunity to educate the buyer and protect yourself, right? Because if you've told them in the definitive agreement, I can't make this rep because this happened, so look at the schedule, you'll protect yourself, right? So be honest, be open, and give them what they need.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, good. We're at 50 minutes. Sorry.
Oh, wow. It's okay. I'll talk about this for hours and hours. Other people don't want to.
I know. So. That went by really quick. So anyway, well, Joe, thanks. I really enjoyed it. You know, as we were having this discussion, I think that what I find is those owners that are already institutionally backed through like VC or PE, you know, they have a pretty good handle on on the stuff that we just talked about. But where I think it would be really valuable is really those like family-owned businesses or just those kind of traditional non-institutionally backed companies that may eventually, well, actually, everybody has an exit.
Correct.
Everybody's going to exit their business one way or another, right? And so I think this will be really helpful.
Great. I hope it was. I hope it didn't carry on too much. I like talking about this stuff.
It's all good. It's all good.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course, Joe. So to all the listeners out there, thank you for hanging in there with us. Hope you took a few nuggets away. And with that, Joe, I'll let you go and get back to your day. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh.
Thanks. And to all the listeners out there, be well. And until next time, have a good one. Thank you for tuning in to Lightning in a Bottle. It's been a pleasure bringing you today's insights from the brightest minds in business. To stay updated with relevant content, exclusive events, and our latest podcast episodes, send us a note to atxwealthpartners.com. Until next time, keep capturing the lightning of innovation and turning it into success. I'm Josh Pottinger, wishing you a productive and prosperous week ahead. And don't forget, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Take care and be well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.